M. Scott Peck was a psychiatrist and an author, and he once wrote this. He said, "We are made for love, and without it, we shrivel. The absence of love rots the spirit and turns us inward in despair." And in his work, as this quote shows, he observed something over time that I think many of us maybe intuitively have come to know or maybe experience in a positive way or a negative way. And I think in general has become a principle that we understand, which is this, that in order for us to really thrive in our lives, for us to grow in our lives, we need love. We need to experience being loved, and we need to express that love to other people. It's core to who we are. And if we don't have that kind of love, if we don't get that experience of love, even from early on in our lives, that leads to an emotional and spiritual stagnation. It actually leads to a place where our lives become fairly hollow or self-centered and isolated. And so Peck talks about the concept of shriveling that he mentioned in that quote, that actually, without love, there is this inward shrinking or shriveling psychologically and spiritually, a condition where individuals fail to mature or grow in their lives, where they plateau at a relatively lack of functioning level, unable to connect deeply with others or even to fully realize their potential. And if you're looking for examples of that, one of the ways that we kind of understand that this is a universal experience, this is part of the human condition. It's not just something that one or two of us have experienced. Even just think about some of the literature or movies, some of the classics, things that we watch or that we read, and think of some of the characters and the themes that come out over and over and over that kind of play out this idea of shriveling or shrinking back when people aren't loved. So I thought of just a couple of examples, classic stories or characters where you can see this happen. Think of Gollum, for example, in The Lord of the Rings. You ever watch Lord of the Rings or read those books? And Gollum, his story right back early, if you kind of go into the background, is that he kills his brother. It's kind of a Cain and Abel story. And that something grows inside of him rather than this love of family that allows him to flourish, is that throughout his life, then there's this tension between good and evil. And you see that throughout those stories, he's this monster oftentimes. And there's these little hints and glimmers of light coming in where you see, oh, he becomes something different. Something really good is there, and yet pulled back into this evil presence that's in his life and that takes over, this hunger for power and for the ring that takes over his life that he seems just not to be able to resist. Think about Eric in the Phantom of the Opera. He is born, and right from his birth, it says that his mother sees his physical appearance and some of the deformities that he has and is totally put off by the ugliness of it. He has an absent father, and so he grows up into a life of isolation and violence and longing for love, a love that he needs to be set free. Think of, there's some Christmas classics, Ebenezer Scrooge. You know about the life of Ebenezer Scrooge, and in that story, it kind of flashes back to his early life, and he has a chance for love, and he has a chance for acceptance, and a certain kind of life, and then he turns away from that and loses that kind of love, and then he too goes in this mode where he loves, but he loves money, he loves success, he loves all the things he's trying to achieve and accomplish, and in that loses the love for the other people, a romantic love, and a family love, and even love for people that he works with, and turns him into this, you know, we talk, that becomes, his name becomes a stand-in for people who, rather than really loving people, love money. It's a Scrooge. Oh, you're being such a Scrooge. You just care so much about money. Think about Beauty and the Beast. The interesting story that literally a man under a curse is turned into something that is hideous, a monster, a beast. And the only thing that can break that curse is love, that he longs for love and for true love to break that curse. And if that happens, he turns back into a man. He restores his humanity. But it's the love that he's lacking or missing and longing for and desiring that is necessary for that. I'm sure if you think hard enough, you can think of all sorts of different books or plays or movies or TV shows where you can see that same theme that comes out, because it is part of the human condition. And perhaps as we recognize it in characters in some of these different media portrayals, we might also recognize it in our own lives. We might also see where there are deficits of love in our lives and how those things have affected how we interact with one another, the world around us, even with God. Love, obviously, is such a powerful, powerful thing. And yet, love, when we use the word love, can mean so many different things for us. We use that word to describe a huge spectrum of things. So think about it. If you go out to your favorite restaurant and you have a great meal and somebody afterwards says to you, oh, that sounds great. You went out to the restaurant. How was the food? You might say, I loved it. You might also say, we have a pet that we absolutely love. We love our children. We love our parents. You might look into the eyes of someone that you've fallen in love with and say, I love you. Or, as we talk about so often in church, we might say that God loves you and that we love God and that we ought to love one another. And when we talk about all those different ways of loving and different objects of our love, we're in some ways talking about the same things, but in some ways we're talking about very different things and very different experiences and a huge spectrum. So decades ago, C.S. Lewis wrote a book called The Four Loves. And in that book, he took what we don't have so much in English, but in Greek, in ancient Greek, there are four different words that we often translate into love. Many of them we find in the Bible. And he goes through kind of each of those different kinds of loves and talks about how we experience them, how we nurture them, what they mean to us in our lives. And I want to do something similar in this series and talk about some of the different aspects and different words that describe love and how they might contribute to our understanding of what it means to be loved and to love, and how that deep experience might help us to really flourish into the kind of people that God has created us to be. Today I'll start with a Greek word that is storge, and storge, often translated love, refers to a type of natural affection or love, typically associated with family relationship. It conveys a sense of natural familial love, the love between parents and children or between family members. So that kind of love, just think about it for example, for a second. Think about the kind of love that you might have for your parents, your children, siblings, people that you grew up with. There is sort of an innate sense of commitment and responsibility to one another. It is the kind of love that has a real experience of belonging, that you grow up in a family and you belong with those people. So some examples of that, take our kids, our children. If you're a parent, you probably have an intuitive motivation to provide for your kids, to care for them, to make sure that they have a home, to make sure that they have basic necessities, that they have food. These are things that might not always be your favorite things to provide. Doesn't mean it's always easy for you to provide, but things that deep down, you know, this is part of what it means to be family. And there's other things, especially as our kids get a little bit older. We drive our kids around to all kinds of activities. When our kids wake up in the middle of the night and they've had a nightmare or they're sick, parents get up with them, we stay with them, we rub their back, we stay up all night with them if we need to. And again, it's not that you kind of walk away from that and go, wow, it was my greatest joy to stay up all night. I'm glad that that happened. Of course not. It's not that it's not tiring to go and to drive your kids around and to take them to different activities and make sure they're here and there. Sometimes you feel like a taxi service, but there's something deep down, a motivation that says, but these are my kids and I love them, and I do what is necessary for them. We belong together, and with that belonging, there's a commitment, and there are certain responsibilities that I have towards them. Perhaps you've experienced the flip side. Maybe you've cared for parents, especially parents that maybe are aging and are in a phase of life where they need more care, and there's certain challenges. Maybe there's health issues, and you as a child, a grown child, just realize that part of being a family is that means You show up. We show up. We show up for the people that we love, the people that we belong with. You do a lot of these things, even when it's not easy, even when it requires sacrifice from you, even when there's other things that you could be doing. But again, there's this instinct that motivates us. And it's, of course, a really good thing. It's a building block, actually, for many other kinds of love. And it's the kind of love where you might do something, you might be there for someone, you might exert yourself to provide for someone else. And you say, oh, this might actually take a lot from me. It might be sacrificial. It might be really draining. But you say, of course I would do that because we're family. We are family. One of the amazing aspects of storge, this kind of love, is that it's not something that always seems to make sense, except that in family it does make sense. And so storge isn't a love necessarily between people who have everything in common. Oh, we love each other because we like all the same things and we have the same hobbies and we have the same personality and we joke around the same way. That could be true. But also in families, you find out that we belong because we're family. Storge grows between people, not so much because they're alike, but because they are committed to each other, because they're in proximity to each other, because they share certain experiences and that deeper bond. And so sometimes what happens in storge love, which is often in family, but not only in family, you build this with other people as well, is that sometimes people that you would say, they really don't seem to fit together. Oh, they really seem to be kind of at odds. These people, I would never peg them to be really close friends because they're just so different and they don't share all the same kinds of interests and stuff like that. But storge is something that's deeper than that and says we have this commitment to each other that goes beyond just our personalities or interests or likes or dislikes. You might even rub somebody the wrong way. It could be somebody you work with and you go, we kind of bristle against each other. But over time, one day you wake up and you go, wow, we've had our moments, but wow, I kind of love them. There's a familiarity. There's a bond that grows over time. Storge is something that you don't necessarily set out to say, wow, we're gonna create this kind of bond. It's more the kind of love that after being with people in certain circumstances for a long time, one day you kind of wake up and you look around and you kind of just realize that it's been growing all the time and it is there, this familiar love that you have for people. Maybe you've experienced that kind of family love deep with people that aren't actually in your biological family. So I know for a lot of people, maybe you grew up and you had people that you called aunt and uncle, even though they weren't your aunt and uncle. My wife grew up that way. She had people that, even to this day, she goes, this is my aunt, this is my uncle. And we use that phrase. That's what we call them when we see them. But they're not actually her aunt and uncle. They're just really good friends of the family. And they're really good friends with her parents. And over time, you build these relationships such that they're like family. And some of those things you would say about your parents or your kids, you'd say, of course I would show up for these people. I'd do anything for these people. These are my people. These are my family. You then say for these people who aren't technically your family, they're not biologically your family, but they become family over time. That's the kind of storge love that grows when you become more and more familiar with people. The people that you have a storge love with might be the kind of friends that when they come over, you don't need to clean up your house. Right? Because when we first start to get to know people a little bit and we build friendships, we're kind of putting our best foot forward and we're trying to put out a really good vibe and a good impression. And so we're oftentimes a little bit more polite and we work a little bit harder. And if it was the first time somebody came over, you're going to make sure everything looks good and everything's neat and they don't think that you're a slob and you've put some effort into it. And the conversation kind of has that polite and even maybe sometimes almost a little bit formal tone as you get to know each other. But people that you build a familiarity with, that family relationship, over time you realize all that stuff falls away because you don't need it anymore. So you don't need to be overly polite. You find yourself being able to talk really plainly with somebody because they kind of get you and you sort of get them. And when they come over, you don't need to impress them and try to make them think that your house most of the time is really clean and tidy because most of the time it's not clean and tidy. But hey, we're family. And we know that. And we can be ourselves in a really plain, ordinary kind of way. And it's just okay. C.S. Lewis writes about this kind of love, and he calls it, translates it into affection. And he says, it is affection that creates this taste, teaching us first to notice, then to endure, then to smile at, then to enjoy, and finally to appreciate the people who happen to be there. Made for us? Thank God, no. They are themselves odder than you could have believed and worth far more than we guessed. It's the kind of love where you might go, they're kind of strange. That person's kind of weird. And they might look at you and think the same thing. And again, you might go, we don't even, you know, in a lot of ways, it doesn't make sense that we would be really close friends. But over time, as we spent time together, we built a relationship and we experienced some things together, we just go along and go, man, they're odd. Maybe I'm odd. But we've become friends. Even we've become family. This type of love is so important because it is about belonging. See that feeling of being comfortable enough to be yourself, that feeling where you realize I don't have to put on airs, I don't have to impress everybody, I can just be myself, the way that you can around your family, if you've got really good family relationships, where you can just go about and, you know, I'm not trying to pretend to be anything that I'm not, is so much about belonging, and we need that. We need to know that we belong just as we are, as weird as we might be, as odd as we might be, with all of our idiosyncrasies, that we belong. Storge is often experienced as that unspoken bond that creates deep belonging and emotional security through a familial identity. And that's where it gets really deep. It's about who we are. We connect because we're family and we belong. And part of our identity is being part of a family. And so even when we're really different, and even when people say it doesn't make a lot of sense, we go, ah, but it fits. And it's kind of comfortable, and it's very familiar. In the New Testament, this word is actually used in the negative. It's used for when it doesn't exist. So listen to this chapter or passage from 2 Timothy chapter 3. And in 2 Timothy chapter 3, there's this warning, and there's a warning of a time, essentially where there's going to be people who are way off base, where things are going really, really wrong. And part of this is a warning against falling into those traps. And here's what it says. It says, at this time, people will love only themselves and their money. They will be boastful and proud, scoffing at God, disobedient to their parents, and ungrateful. They will consider nothing sacred. So really strong language. This is obviously not something that's that's good news. This is not where you want to get. This is not the kind of crowd you want to run with. This is not the kind of person that you want to become. And it's going to make us think of some of those examples that we talked about right at the beginning. People who have, look, they've learned to love their money, but not their parents. They're not grateful. Nothing is sacred. Everything has just become profane. And then it says, they will be unloving. That's our word, storge, except the negative version of it doesn't exist. Some translations say they will be heartless and unforgiving. They will slander others and have no self-control. They will be cruel and hate what is good. They will betray their friends, be reckless, be puffed up with pride, and love pleasures rather than God. They will act religious, but they will reject the power that could make them godly. Stay away from people like that. Right? It reminds you of some of those stories. They love money. They've learned to love pleasure, but not their parents. It says that they'll betray their friends. They love pleasure more than they love God. They put on all these airs, they act religious, they put on a show, but they reject what actually can change their lives and what is godly. And the warning is, you got to get away from that kind of living. That will not help you to flourish in your life. Because as humans, we were built, we were created to receive and to give love. And without that love running through our lives, we will shrivel back. You can't flourish in that way. You need this love that brings friends and family together in familiarity, in a deep bond that is stronger than our bonds for success or for love or for pleasure, love that has the object of someone else or even something else. Sometimes this kind of love even geared towards pets and animals. And that's not to lessen it, it's to say there's actually something really there of companionship, even with the pets that we absolutely love. Is it exactly the same as the way that we love a human friend or family member? No, but it doesn't mean that there's not something significant there as well. Jesus, so interesting. When Jesus talks about family, Jesus is actually shocking when he talks about family. And in Jesus' culture, you would expect that there'd be certain things that Jesus would say to uphold maybe traditional views of family. But Jesus is oftentimes, he's very shocking. And the things that he says, he often says them in a way, I think, to intentionally provoke people to think. He says them in a very shocking way. So listen to what Jesus says, and he doesn't use the Greek word storge, but you'll see that he's talking about this kind of familial love. And listen to what he says about family. This is Matthew chapter 12. And by the way, Jesus, the context for this is Jesus has been, he's been teaching, he's been performing signs, miracles, and there's crowds around him, but he's a divisive figure. And so there's some people who love him and think this is the person we've been waiting for. And there's some people that hate him and they think that he's possessed by a demon. And that has to be difficult. It'd be difficult for anybody to endure. Like, it's great. On the one side, there's people who are for you and following you. On the other side, there's people who are opposing you and coming against you. And many of these people are his own people, fellow Jews, people from where he was from and all around. And they were supposed to be kind of there for each other. And so Jesus, in the back of his mind, he's dealing with all of this. This is what he says. It says, as Jesus was speaking to the crowd, his mother and brothers stood outside asking to speak to him. Someone told Jesus, your mother and your brothers are standing outside and they want to speak to you. Jesus asked, who is my mother? Who are my brothers? Then he pointed to his disciples and said, look, these are my mother and brothers. Anyone who does the will of my Father in heaven is my brother and sister and mother. This is shocking because in his culture, which is an honor-shame culture, in which one of the greatest things, responsibilities that you have is to bring honor to your family by how you live, by the work that you do, by the way you portray your family in society, by the way you treat them. This could have really looked like he was almost shaming his family. Yo, your family's out here. They want to talk to you. And he goes, this is my family, the ones who are my disciples. This is my brother. This is my mother. He reinvents who it is that is his family. And instead of just a biological family, which again, and to a greater degree than we experience in the Western world, where we're typically, we love our families, I understand, but we're very individualistic compared to many cultures of the world and in history, where they were so deeply rooted in their family, their identity rooted in their family. For Jesus to say this is shocking, but he is saying that my family, and I don't think he's trying to put down his biological family. I think he's trying to elevate another kind of family. He says, my family is the one who does the will of my Father in heaven. That's my brother and sister and mother. He now goes, the kind of bond that you experience in a really good, deep family, biologically, that roots your identity, he's saying, I'm reframing the spiritual community in that way. And my family are the ones who do the will of God. As we go on a spiritual journey together to figure out what God wants us to do in our life and how we experience all the love he pours into our life and all the love he wants to pour through our lives, those of us who are on that journey together, we are family. That's my brother and sister, and that's my mother together. We are family. And so Jesus is reshaping, actually, he's reshaping social norms, suggesting that, well, the family relationship has a place. It's a great thing. There's actually a higher allegiance to God's kingdom. And there to find these deep, familial bond, defining markers of our identity and who we are, now becoming those of us who are pursuing the will of the Father. Obedience to God is more defining for our identity than even our biological connections. And so in this, Jesus, I believe, doesn't diminish the love of family, but he extends it to go further. So listen to this, and I think this, if you really picture this, is such a moving moment. In John chapter 19, Jesus has been nailed to the cross, and there his disciples and his family are there. And so just, I mean, picture the extremely, extremely painful moment, obviously for Jesus, but also for his family. And it says that his mother was there. Could you imagine? Could you imagine as a parent, here, your child is being executed. And this is what it says in John chapter 19. Standing near the cross were Jesus' mother and his mother's sister, Mary, the wife of Clopas, and Mary Magdalene. When Jesus saw his mother standing there beside the disciple he loved, he said to her, "Dear woman, here is your son." And he said to this disciple, "Here is your mother." And from then on, this disciple took her into his home. See, Jesus wasn't giving up his actual biological family. He was extending it. And he was saying, when we come together as a spiritual community, we have the opportunity to build these strong family bonds that root us in an identity together as beloved children of God, right? So this becomes a bigger circle, and we draw together, and we can be ourselves, and we can drop the airs, and we can become comfortable with one another to the point where the family gets bigger and bigger, so much so that when Jesus' mother is looking at him and one of his best friends, they're looking at him, he's being executed, and they realize he's not going to be there. He goes, Mom, here's your son. For a mother, by the way, Mary's husband, Joseph, he drops out of the story really early on. We assume that that means that Joseph died early in Jesus' life, because after the birth narratives and a quick story, when Jesus is a child, Joseph doesn't show up anymore. So she's probably a widow who needs to be taken care of, needs a son and family members. That's how that society worked. Your family members care for you. And here's Jesus making sure that his mother is taken care of, making sure that the family bonds he's been building and extending, you know, transcending even biological connections. Mom, here's your son. And he looks at his friend. He says, here's your mother. And from then on, they took care of each other because they had built those family bonds, even though they weren't technically family to that point. And this is what Jesus is doing. He's building a new community. He's building a universality. He's building a way for us to look at one another and say, we're invited to be family. What an incredible opportunity for us to experience that family type of love, that storge type of love that roots us in identity and commitment to each other and responsibility for each other. And that's so powerful because many of us might not have experienced that in other ways, that there is that void. And so Jesus calls us to gather and to say one of the ways that we can help fill the void for one another is to extend our families and to love each other. How do we do that? Couple of points of application. Actually, I want you to think of how to do that. Maybe just to think a little bit differently about our church relationships with one another and how you and how we operate together. And just maybe brainstorm on this question. Ask yourself this. How can I foster environments of relational proximity? So like I said before, storge, that kind of love, builds. It's not so much that you go, oh, today we're going to become family. It's more that over time, through familiarity, through things like shared experiences, commitment, showing up for one another, being not only physically in proximity to each other, just physically close to each other, but also creating opportunities where you can open up to be emotionally and spiritually close to one another and intimate with one another, that over time, all of that closeness builds until one day you wake up and say, huh, last person I thought we'd be really close to, but here we are. I think we're kind of family. So how could you foster environments of relational proximity, especially when it comes to our spiritual community? So think about when you come to church on Sunday mornings. This is, you know, one of the times that many of us, we find, you know, a big challenge to having deep relationships is our schedules and the pressures that are on us in our lives and how much work we have to do and all the rest of it. But many of us make the effort. We come out on Sunday mornings. This is a time that we give. What if, as you came to church on Sunday morning, as you prepared yourself to show up to church, as you prayed about coming to church, you're asking yourself, how do I not just show up to a service? How do I not come in late and leave as soon as it's over? But how do I use this as an opportunity to place myself in proximity with people who maybe aren't even that much like me? Are there ways where I could open myself up to stick around to have a conversation with somebody maybe that I don't know that well? Could I give myself a little bit time to be a little bit early so that there's a chance? Could I stay a little bit late? Could I come to some of the events or some of the services that we have and we just, you know, by the way, this is why sometimes there's a potluck or there's a lunch or there's ice cream after the service. This is what we're trying to do, is to say, what if there was opportunity for us to build a little bit more of a relational proximity? For some of us, I know it's a challenge schedule-wise. We ask or we offer to get into a group, get into a life group. And to show up and not only to be in a life group and just physically be in a group, but to come and open yourself up and to say, I want to be a place where I'm sharing my life with somebody else. I'm sharing my experiences. I'm sharing the things that I'm going through. Maybe more importantly, I'm listening to what you're going through. I'm listening to your challenges and your joys, and I'm sharing in them. And over time, maybe it's weeks, maybe it's months, maybe it's years, to find that familiarity built. Maybe it's volunteering, because some of the ways that we build these really strong, deep relationships is by doing things together and accomplishing things together and being side by side and learning about each other in those ways. And so I would offer, those are three ways. There's plenty more that you might brainstorm and just say, not only doing these things, but the way that you do these things, with the openness that you have, with the mentality you come into community with of saying, I'm not just coming to sing a few songs. I'm not just coming to, there's a half an hour of work we're doing together. We volunteer. I'm not just getting through questions and that we discuss, but I want to come and place myself in not only physical, but relational, emotional proximity to other people, such that one day I'll look around and say, oh, these people are kind of like family. There's this couple, if you've been around Westside for a number of years, you might have known them. Both of them have passed away. Their names were Bruce and Joyce, and Bruce and Joyce were this amazing couple, and I knew them a little bit growing up here at the church. But when I started as the pastor, my wife and I were in our 20s, and Bruce and Joyce were here every single week. They were the kind of people that absolutely loved Jesus, they loved the church, and they loved children, and they loved students. And so every week, Bruce was part of the welcome team. He'd be on the front door, and Bruce would show up. He was one of the coolest guys. So we were in our 20s. They were in their 70s. Bruce would show up. He would always be dressed to the nines. I remember he had this amazing, thick, pinstripe suit. It kind of looked like maybe he was in the mob or something, and I loved it. He had this long, flowing gray hair down to his shoulders. He was like an amazing guy, and he loved McMaster students as our building is close to the university, and there was this one year where it just so happened that the bus times lined up, 5 minutes from our service time, and so there would be a bus that would stop right in front of the church building here in Hamilton, like 5 minutes before the service would start, and there was all kinds of students from Mac that would come, and so like an entire busload of students would get off and come right into the church, and he would get so excited about this. So I had an office at the time down the hall, and I could remember 5-10 minutes before the service, all of a sudden I could hear Bruce's voice from all the way down at the front door, and he would be yelling to the rest of the welcome team, battle stations, they're here, and he just loved, because he loved to welcome them, and he loved the young life, and all this, and he did it for years and years and years, and they loved to see kids in our kids' ministry, and they prayed for them faithfully, and they were so wonderful. And I remember as we started out, again, we were so different. I mean, we dressed different, we acted different, we probably had different opinions on things. Our age gap was probably about 50 years. But every week, we just got to know Bruce and Joyce a little bit better. And they started inviting us over to their apartment, my wife and I, and we would play Crokinole, a little game, you flick the disc and get points. And to be honest with you, Crokinole on a Friday night was not something my wife and I would usually do in our 20s, but Bruce and Joyce would invite us over, and we'd go to their apartment, and they were in their 70s, and we would stay there till all hours of the night, playing Crokinole, and over time, telling stories and hearing about their life, and laughing and laughing and laughing. And one day, we just realized, wow, they are like family. We love Bruce and Joyce, and they love us, and we would do anything for them, and they would do anything for us. And yet you might look and go, I mean, if you just take a look at us two couples, you probably wouldn't have gone, wow, they're going to be great friends, and yet we became family. And that is the powerful opportunity we have with storge love, as we put ourselves in proximity with one another. It's what love can look like. When strangers become friends, friends become family, and it's together we experience God's love and share him with the world. Heavenly Father, we thank you for the love that you have for us. Thank you for welcoming us into your family. Thank you that we're not distant, but we are your children. We pray that that kind of belonging rooted in your love would be the kind of love that helps us to flourish and helps us to grow and to mature and brings joy to our lives. As we enjoy each other, even in the ways at first we might never have thought we would have. But thank you that that's what you've done for us, and help us to do that for one another. In Jesus' name, amen.